This week on the show, we finally start our Patriots training camp preview. Sean McAdam of Boston Sports Journal calling in from the Red Sox West Coast road trip. Mike Zagel of Snap Call Sports recaps the U.S. Open with us. All that and more coming up. Calling It starts right now. Welcome to Calling It. How's it going, Alex?
It's going well.
I'm excited. You know why? Well, I'm always excited when we start the show, to be fair, because I love the sound of my own voice. But you know why I'm excited this week?
I think I have a pretty good idea.
You have a good idea? You hear that?
I do.
You know what that is?
It sounds like bells.
You know why?
It's a start of training camp.
It's the most wonderful time of the year. Football season is right around the corner. Again, you're listening to Calling It, Alex Barth, Alex Lebowitz. Brought to you by Snap Call Sports. Thanks for tuning in. That is right. This Thursday, the Patriots will take the field behind Gillette. Football is back. For those of you who have been following the show since the beginning, first of all, thank you.
Sincerely.
I started the show, I think it was the week after the divisional playoff games. Mm-hmm. No, it was the week, divisional AFC championship games. But we haven't done much. We talked about that. We talked about the Super Bowl, but it was really still, you know, a cut and dry operation at that point. We did a little bit of the NFL draft, but, you know, basically till February, get ready to hear a lot of football on the show, because I think you would consider yourself primarily a football guy.
Football, yeah. Football and baseball, probably 1 and 1A.
I'm primarily a football guy, so, I mean, we're looking for enough about us. Just get it. Let's talk football. Yeah. Why am I delaying this?
You're delaying.
All right. So training camp starts on Thursday morning, 9 a.m., teams take the field. Look, we could talk about, watch Tom Brady. It's another year. I never watched Tom Brady at training camp. I know what I'm getting with him. Yeah. I'm not going to learn anything. It's the position battles. It's the nitty gritty. Mm-hmm. That's what I want to get into here. You know, if you want to hear fawning over Tom Brady, go to Barstool. I have no problem with them, but we're going to get a little more X's and O's.
Yes.
So let's start. What position are you most interested in, like how it's going to iron out? Which position do you think right now is the biggest question mark, not necessarily in terms of what can they bring, but who is going to be taking the field?
That running back core definitely is the one position I'm looking at. And you know, they're stacked. You look at Rex Burkhead, Gillisley, you have Deion Lewis, James White. You have all these guys. One of them has to go. At least one of them has to go. Will it be Deion Lewis? I don't think James White's leaving. I think we're going to see a surprise cut in that backfield, and that's the one thing I'm looking at.
I think we can finally be done with the DJ Foster talk. And yeah. For the last couple of years, we've been hearing about how he'll be a contributor. I've never really thought he was that special. I think Deion Lewis is a bubble guy. I really do. Given his injury history, I'm sure Bill would love to slip him onto the PUP and wait 8 weeks, and I think that's certainly on the table. But, yeah, I don't think they're as stacked as we all think they are. I think they're well-rounded,
yeah.
But I was never a huge fan of Gillisley. I don't think he's necessarily worth the contract he got. I think the Patriots are trying to get the Bills to do something stupid. You know, White's good. He had a very good year last year. We'll see how he follows up. Lewis, obviously, the injury concerns. Burkhead, to me, is not the guy. I think some of these guys are overrated. Burkhead's a great special teams player. He's a decent third option at running back. They're well-rounded. You have guys who can do everything. James White is a great pass catcher. Lewis running outside the tackles. Gillisley inside the tackles. Burkhead's a great blocking back. They're well-rounded. I don't know if they're stacked. I don't think we're unless they're really up and they need, which is going to happen this year, and they need Gillisley to just be the closer like LeGarrette Blount was last year. And I don't think we're done with LeGarrette Blount either, by the way.
Oh, yeah, I'll never. He could be 50 years old, I think, Bill Belichick.
Unless it's one of those, you know, just pound the rock, one out the clock, yeah. We're up 40 at halftime kind of games. I don't think you're going to see any of the running backs get more than 20 snaps per game.
Oh, no.
I think it's going to be pretty evenly balanced.
I think they intentionally went with a more versatile group, though. It's like you don't have that, like, quote-unquote, power back like you did with LeGarrette Blount.
You do, but he's not a feature back.
Yeah. And I just think they have guys who can both, you know, run, and they can be another option for Brady. I think they're trying to be a little less predictable. I don't know.
It definitely makes them less predictable, and that's a great point.
Yeah.
So, because you knew it was happening last year based on what running back was in the game.
Exactly. Like, LeGarrette Blount's not going out, and he's not going to be a target for Brady. When LeGarrette Blount's in there, he's either blocking or they're running the ball. You can't really assume that with this group. And I think that's what Belichick was going for. Still, someone's going to be gone. Regardless, though, I you know, this running back corps is not stacked. It's not, but they don't have to be. They've never had to be.
Them not being stacked is not a bad thing. They're very well-rounded, which with a coach like Belichick, that's What I'm honestly looking at most when I go to training camp, I'm curious, and you mentioned the blocking of LeGarrette Blount. He's a good blocker. Deion Lewis isn't. He's too small. He's not strong enough.
Yeah.
It's not his game. It's not his fault. It's not his game. But Brady's going to need that protection. They're going to face a lot of blitz this year. Rex Burkhead, to me, is the guy in this unit that you're going to put in the shotgun and have protect Brady. And he didn't do a lot of that in Cincinnati. I'm not sure. I've heard from what I've read and what I've seen, it seems like he's a decent blocker. But I'm really curious to see how he's going to fit into the Patriots' blocking scheme, how Skarnecki, and you know, there's very little work between Skarnecki and the running backs, but Skarnecki is working on the blocking schemes, how Burkhead's going to factor into that. That's the biggest thing for me this year with the running back.
I think that's less of a priority this season, just given a blocking running back or you know, the strength of their pass blocking in general. You look at Brady, he's always been a guy who gets the ball and he throws. And it was a little less of that last year, and yet Brandon Cooks, who's more of a
Going to want to open it up. And we'll talk to Sean McAdam later of Boston Sports Journal, but there was a piece on Boston Sports Journal today by Christopher Price, and he talked about the one area, from what he heard, people near the organization, the Patriots were 12th last year in big play percentage, runs of 10-plus yards or passes of 25-plus yards. They were at about 8%, which is 12th, which is pretty good, but they want to be higher. They want to be in the top 10 in that statistic. It's, I think, a big reason they brought Brandon Cooks in, and a big part of that, you know, any big play, you need the burner, the wide receiver for the runs, you need the guy who can make people miss. Any big play starts with the offensive line.
Oh, for sure. And you know what? I still think they're going to be a step above what they were last year. So that could play into it as well. The reality is, if the Patriots running back corps isn't the best at pass blocking, I'm not going to be too up in arms about it. I think they're still overall going to be better than they were last year. I think the addition of Burkhead and Gillislee and a James White, who's a year older, that's going to help out. It's going to carry the load a little bit more for Deion Lewis, and they won't have to rely on going to LeGarrette Blount consistently like they did last year. They don't need a guy who's going to, you know, run for 17 touchdowns. They just need a group that does the job. They have that with that running back core, and it's funny because that's probably one of the weaker parts of this Patriots team, but they're still good.
They're well-read. They don't have that superstar you have in other units, but they might be the most well-rounded unit. And that kind of leads me into the position I'm looking at the most. That may have more star power than any other on the squad is the cornerback position and the defensive backs. But I'm still wondering who the slot corner is going to be on this team. We talked to Mike Girardi about this last week. Right, and Butler being the slot corner, which I think we'll see at times, and this was something else he talked about. Statistically, outside of quarterback, the toughest position to evaluate and bring in undrafted talent is corner. Mm-hmm. And if you look at what the Patriots have done in the last couple of years, Malcolm Butler, obviously, we know what he turned into. Last year, you had Cravon LeBlanc, who they ultimately cut, which I still think was a mistake. They cut Cravon LeBlanc. He goes, and he is a functional corner. He was a good second corner for the Chicago Bears. They didn't have a good first corner, unfortunately, or just about anything else. But he was a good player for them. He was a legitimate NFL number two corner. You had Jonathan Jones they brought in undrafted. He was a contributor last year. The Patriots seem to have this formula to identify undrafted corners. So that brings me to DJ Killings, undrafted corner, Iowa State. There isn't much tape on him, and I was able to watch tape on Cravon LeBlanc last year, and I kind of formulated that opinion going into training camp that I liked him, and he was very impressive in training camp, impressive in the preseason. I'm really excited to see Killings, because if they can continue to bring in this talent at the cornerback position, other than the draft, it's going to be huge. And with Malcolm Butler pretty much gone next year, I think that's, it's safe to say, it could be a big year for him. He sizes up like a slot corner. He's got quick feet, and he can play on special teams. So this is a guy I think is not on a lot of people's radar that could be a factor when you get down to that 53-man cut. I'm excited to see what he can do. I'm also excited to see what Eric Rowe does. A full year in the system now. Size-wise, I mean, he's ideal. 6'1", 215, long arms. Exactly what we want out of a corner. I think he's going to be spelling Butler and Gilmore a lot to keep them fresh. I think it'll be rare you see both those guys on the field at the same time early in games. I think we'll be one with Rowe, and they'll alternate. But I'm excited to see what Rowe can do as well. But the corners and the defensive backs, Jerron Harmon coming back, I think a three-safety set is going to be their base this year. And I'm excited to see just kind of what Belichick does with that position. The pass rush is better this year than it was last year. Yes. So he can get a lot more creative with what he does in the secondary. He's got some nice pieces now with Gilmore. That's the unit I can't wait to kind of see, because I think that unit, from a game plan point of view, is going to change more than any other.
I agree. There's two guys that I'm looking at in that secondary. It's one of them, Cyrus Jones. Will he be able to bounce back?
I'm a big Alabama guy. I really hope so.
You know what? He's a second round pick. It's only his second season. Maybe he just had a tough time adjusting. He comes back better this
and
year.
He barely got to play corner last year. He's right there in the running. I think it's him and the Joneses right there in the run. Jonathan Jones and Killings for the slot corner. And right now it's probably Jonathan Jones' position to lose. But I watched a lot of Cyrus Jones at Alabama. That guy can play. It was mental last year. If he can get his head right, he can be a huge difference maker.
Absolutely. I mean, he has the talent. So will he be able to come around, or will he lose his spot to an undrafted rookie? Who knows?
I think it'll help that he won't have to return kicks this year. I would assume he won't be returning kicks
this year. I hope not. I mean, he's going to muff every other punt.
Right. We'll see if they have him back there at camp, but I would think that, you know, they bring in Cooks, they bring in Burkhead, who can return kicks a little bit.
Yeah, and you always have Amendola, who's old reliable. And Stephon Gilmore is another guy who, you know, there's a lot of hype from that signing. People think he was overpaid, but no one's really talked about, like, what will his impact be with this Patriots team? How big of a step up will it be from last year when he was on the Bills? Because you got to think, you come to the Patriots, you're going to be put in a system that's going to be better for you. You're going to be coached by a better staff, and you're probably going to play to more of your potential. I want to see how he does. I don't want to see how that duo of him and Malcolm Butler really dominates the AFC East, because the last time the Patriots had a cornerback duo like this was Revis and Browner. I think that's a fair comparison. Maybe not quite as good, but I'm excited to see him play. I want to see if he lives up to the hype, and I think he's going to really be one of the top cornerbacks in the NFL this year. And I know it's probably not the hottest take to look out for that guy, but he's the new signing. It's him and Brandon Cooks, the two biggest signings from the offseason, or additions, rather.
I will say this, not just the cornerback duos for Belichick, but Belichick doesn't really get a lot of bump and run corners. It's a rare breed. No team has a lot of bump and run corners, but I'm not counting Browner in this. Browner was a bump and bump corner. He wasn't really bump and run.
He's a pass interference
bump and hold corner. Yeah. You know, the last really bump and run corners Belichick have had are Samuel and Ty Law. Samuel and Ty Law. And then what's his name? Lee Bawden, who was a decent player, was a bump and run corner. So you can't, what I think Patriots fans are going to be upset about, Gilmore's weakness is the deep ball. And because he's one of those bigger guys and he's quicker, people expect him to be good against the deep ball. He's not. He's good at jamming guys in the line. He is the answer this year to Mike Evans, to Julio Jones, to Kelvin Benjamin when they have to go play the NFC South. He's going to body those guys up on the line and force them to the middle of the field. He's not there to defend go routes. And I want Patriots fans to understand that, because when Gilmore gets beat, you saw it last year against Hogan, he gets beat bad. But what he can do at the line of scrimmage counterbalances that. You really need to watch Gilmore fighting within that 5 to 10 yard area to see the difference he makes. If you're only looking at him on the deep ball, you're not going to think he's that good of a player.
And the reality is, if he does get beat, you have a really good safety group.
I would assume he's going to have help over the top.
Absolutely. Yeah. So you have Devin McCourty, Patrick Chung, and Daron Harmon, who are all, that's one of the top safety groupings in the NFL, if you ask me. The whole secondary is going to be great. They're going to have help over the top. They're going to have, obviously, the cornerback group is awesome. And you said it, the pass rush is going to be even better. So I think we're looking at another season where the Patriots defense gives up the least amount of points in the NFL and is among top five in a lot of statistical categories.
I think the yard, because of the addition of guys like Gilmore, I think the yards thing might be a little better too.
Absolutely.
In terms of Ben, and they're never going to go away from Ben Don't Break. Belichick loves Ben Don't Break. Mm-hmm. It works for him. But, you know, Gilmore's instinct is to defend that 5 yard pass that Belichick doesn't mind giving up. And that's going to help. Let's talk about that pass rush, though, because you mentioned the pass rush. And I actually got in a debate with a friend of mine, longtime season ticket holder, who's saying that he's not sure about this pass rush this year. And there seems to be some question marks about it. I'm not sure where they're coming from. This pass rush has to be they are better players on the pass rush this year than there were last year. It's deeper and there's more talent. They lose Chris Long. They lose Jabal Sheard, who didn't really play.
He had a bad year last year.
They had Derek Rivers, who I think is going to be, look, not right off the bat. There's always that one guy. Think of Keem Ayers 3 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
First 8-10 weeks is invisible and then has a huge impact down the stretch. That's Derek Rivers to me. He's a huge add. Coney Ealy,
yeah,
I think is an upgrade over Chris Long. I think he's a better, because he can do more as a pass rusher than Chris Long can do.
Also one of the best trades made this offseason. They moved 8 spots back and got him. Like,
and
that's all.
Most teams, that's their best offseason move. And yeah. That's a footnote.
Yeah.
And then, not that he's a pass rusher, but the addition of David Harris, and mm-hmm. Tyler Sullivan talked with about this with us a couple weeks ago, means Dont'a Hightower can rush the passer more. He doesn't have to play the Mike linebacker as much. He can play on the outside. And Pro Football Focus had him ranked as one of the top pass rushing linebackers in the league last year. He just didn't get to do it very often.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you add in, you add, air quotes, add Hightower to the pass rush. Rivers is a very high motor guy. Ealy, Lawrence Guy is another one of these, you know, not a big name, but sabermetrically very sound defensive lineman. I think this pass rush is going to be, I don't want to say elite, but they should be top 10 in the league in sacks this year, or at least quarterback hurries.
You got to think. And another thing is they're young. Like, a lot of these guys are young.
Really young.
They got Trey Flowers.
You're not even – Trey Flowers adds another year of experience, too. Didn't even mention
and
him.
And he led the team in sacks last year. Like, low-key led the team. Not that they were a great pass-rushing team, but he had the most sacks on
the Super Bowl winning team. He was a threat last year.
Absolutely. You have Malcolm Brown, who's a year older, maybe not a pass rusher per se, but the interior line's going to be a little bit better. Vincent Valentine, a year older. A lot of these guys are you know, you mentioned it a couple weeks ago. They make that jump from year 2 to 3. You got a lot of guys who are going from that year 2 to 3 or 1 to 2 or 3 to 4. So there's going to be some guys who we're not even talking about that are going to make that jump this season. You got to think. And that's what I'm looking forward to mostly in this defensive line, because you got that veteran presence. Obviously, Ninkovic, a guy we haven't even talked about, might be cut. He's kind of who I think they might move away from. And then you have, you know, Flowers, Brown, Valentine, who are all the young guys who might not get a ton of time. But still, this is going to be a good front seven in general. Again, just well-rounded defensive team.
Look, I just don't want to hear in week 5 or 6 when they're playing these juggernaut NFC South offenses and giving up a million yards, oh, this defense sucks. Oh, secondary's so bad. Like the Seattle game last year. Mm-hmm. And granted, they didn't play great. They were going with the two-man rush.
Yeah.
The secondary wasn't up to it. But that's kind of what they want to do. Ultimately, they allowed a lot of field goals in that game, even though they were giving up the huge plays. They're rushing too, and they're saying, you know what, throw the ball down the field. We'll stop you at the one. We'll make you kick a field goal. I just don't – when the Patriots are playing, especially against those high-powered offenses, this defense isn't meant to stop teams from picking up yards. It's meant to stop teams from scoring touchdowns.
Yeah, red zone defense.
And I feel like that's what a lot of casual Patriots fans don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, it just bugs me to see that. Oh, they gave up so many yards. It's like they gave up 13 points.
The name of the game, if you're on defense, is to limit the other team from scoring points.
Right.
They were as good at that as any other team in the NFL last year. The yards, it's irrelevant. When it comes down to that time when, you know, they're within the 30, they make teams settle for field goals. That's not going to change this year.
And look, when it gets down to crunch time, they need to make the stop. The Jets game last year in New York, they forced the fumble in the Super Bowl, forcing the fumbles, getting the sacks. They can crank down when they need to. They just don't want to get beat with the big play.
Yeah.
They'll give you 5-10 yards, and I'm okay with that. It's frustrating to watch, but I'm okay with that because it works.
Absolutely. They're a smart team. And they always have been. And this year, they're not only smart, they're talented. They're not only one of the best coach defenses in the NFL, they're one of the most skilled and deepest. The thing is, injuries are going to happen. That's bound to happen.
Right.
Someone goes down the defensive line, you have so many guys
so
who are ready
depth.
To step up. That's the thing. Like, every team experiences injuries. The Patriots are not going to be any different, but guess what? When they do experience that injury, they're going to have the depth to fill the void that's missing there.
I mean, we've talked about this before on the show. This may be the best all-around roster they've had.
I think it is.
In the Super Bowl run.
Mike Giardi, last week, he said he put this roster up against that 07 team, and he picked a lot of the guys on this team over that 07 team.
But even you look at 04...
Yep.
You look, I mean, relatively, you want to go back to 76, and that was a great team.
Yeah.
I've been watching all the old, like, yearbooks, like the half hour, you know, just kind of going through the season on the team because I've been so football deprived. And that 76 team had a lot of good – I mean, Steve Grogan was just coming into his own. Mm-hmm. Russ Francis, one of the more underrated players in Patriots history, was a great tight end. You had a great defense. He still had John Hanna. And he, I mean, we're not talking about 76 right now.
That's a different era. Anyway, we'll do another segment on that 76 Patriots team.
Hey, if you have the Super Bowl 36 DVD, there's the whole 20-minute thing of that team. If it's not for that horrible call, the phantom roughing the passer in Oakland on Sugar Bear Hamilton, that team goes to and maybe wins the Super Bowl. I wasn't even alive. I'm bitter about that. Anyway, we have a lot more we can get into about 1976, 86, 97, 2017, really. We'll save all the other years maybe for a slow news week. Maybe the bye week.
Yes.
Maybe the bye week will take a little all-time look. But a lot more I want to get into about this 2017 team. We have a lot more to cover, though, as well. And we do still have a couple weeks of training camp. So we'll get into it, you know, more next week. I want to talk about the tight ends. Obviously, Brady Garoppolo. We'll get more to that next week. Right now, though, Red Sox, big West Coast road trip. Sean McAdam is out there. He's going to call in and tell us what's going on the West Coast. Keep it right here. You're listening to Callin' It, brought to you by Snap Call Sports.
Callin' It is a Snap Call Sports production. Snap Call Sports is available for iPhone or Android download. Snap Call, the game within the game.
Welcome back to Callin' It. We are now joined by Boston Sports Journal's Red Sox beat writer, Sean McAdam, a new Boston Sports Journal beat writer, Sean McAdam. Sean, how are you doing?
I'm well, Alex. How are you?
We're doing well. Late flight last night. Team now in Seattle, starting a three-game set with the Mariners. Obviously, all attention right now on Rafael Devers, the 20-year-old prospect, getting the call-up over the weekend. So, Sean, the big question, when are we going to see this kid?
Well, I don't think tonight, because he was due to be flying out this morning, I think, and as they did with Andrew Benintendi, who ironically made his major league debut almost exactly a year ago, also in Seattle. They give him a day to kind of get acclimated, you know, get some work in. And I think the fact that the Mariners are starting a left-hander tonight is one more reason that they'll wait and probably get him in the starting lineup tomorrow. So a 20-year-old gets to make his major league debut against King Felix Tuesday night against Seattle. That's not the easiest introduction, but that's the way it goes sometimes.
Yeah, does that factor into the decision at all, who the opposing starting pitcher is for his debut?
Well, I think they're keeping him out today, as I said, to sort of, you know, if he'd been able to fly out last night and get adjusted to the time difference and get a good night's sleep, then maybe they would have disregarded the fact that a lefty was starting tonight and get him in there. But as I said, I think they found last year, and if you'll recall, Benintendi ended up getting into the game as a pinch hitter on that first game. So even though he wasn't in the starting lineup or scheduled to play, he did end up making his major league debut on the first game he was with the team. And who knows, late in the game tonight, we could see Devers off the bench in a pinch hitting role too. But I think their experiences is that they believe it's a good idea to, you know, let him get comfortable here. There's going to be a lot of attention, a lot of hoopla. He'll have flown most of the day, and I think they just want him to get comfortable and then sort of start fresh tomorrow when he's in the lineup.
Was this a move that was made because Devers is ready, or was this a move made because the Red Sox are just desperate?
Well, desperate might be a bit of a overstatement. They are, despite, you know, being a game under 500 since the All-Star break, they're still in first place. So I don't think desperate applies here. But certainly they could use a boost offensively, a little bit of shot in the arm that sometimes comes with a young player and the energy that they bring. I think there's a lot of factors. I think they believe he's ready to contribute at least in some way, and that may be limited to right-handed pitching initially. They could surely use somebody who has the power that he has shown in the minor leagues with about 20 homers at the minor league level at the age of 20. It may also be, somewhat related to the trade deadline, which is now a week away, and you've got the prospect of some third baseman out there and available, and maybe this is Dave Dombrowski's way of saying that they don't see a whole lot out there that interests them, particularly given the asking price for some of these more established third basemen. So, you know, before we end up packaging a couple of prospects we might regret sending away, let's take a look at what we have here and see if maybe he can help us. And, it's not going to be much of an evaluation period before the deadline rolls around, because he's not going to play tonight, or at least he's not going to start tonight. And they're off on Thursday after the end of the West Coast trip. So at most, he's going to get about 5 games in before the deadline. And I don't know that you make any determination on what that means or whether you need somebody or don't need somebody from the outside. But it's clear that the Red Sox don't like the options available to them, at least now on the deadline. And maybe the fact that there aren't a lot of teams, now that Todd Frazier has landed with the Yankees, there don't seem to be a lot of other contenders looking to upgrade at third. So the Red Sox may think that the asking price for those third basemen who are available has been artificially inflated, and given the market, they expect it will come down. In the meantime, they're going to take a look at a guy who might be the answer to their problems in-house without having to give up anything.
Again, we're talking to Sean McAdam of BostonSportsJournal.com. Obviously, for all the Benintendi comparisons that are being made about Devers, and the comparison is there. Also, comparisons to Yoan Moncada, who was brought up as a 20-year-old international free agent and didn't live up to expectations, didn't really come close. What prevents Devers from becoming Yoan Moncada?
Well, I think he's more advanced as a hitter. Although, like Moncada, he has had some difficulty hitting some breaking pitches. He can hit a fastball, we know that. But as Moncada showed, they find out pretty quickly up here what your weaknesses are and then go about exploiting them until you make an adjustment. And there's no question that with Moncada last September, there was the book got around pretty quickly on him, that this is a guy who would chase out of the zone, and until you prove you can hit that pitch or at least lay off it, they're going to keep throwing it to you. And we saw all those strikeouts that racked up for Moncada. So there is no guarantee that he's going to be any more ready than Moncada was. But I think the determination that they made was, even if he comes up here and fails, and that's a very real possibility, not only for Devers, but any 20-year-old making a leap to the big leagues. But even if he fails, they believe he can handle it mentally, that it's not going to shake his confidence or send him backwards or propel him into this spiral where the rest of the season is lost and he's not developing as you'd hoped at the minor league level. I think as much as anything, this speaks to what they think of his maturity and his makeup as much as his baseball ability right now.
So if he does hit, the biggest need becomes bullpen. Trade deadline is always a popular time to expand the bullpen. But before we get to that, in-house, a couple guys on the DL right now. When can Red Sox fans expect to see Joe Kelly again? And what have you heard about Carson Smith? Is he still expected to pitch this year?
Yeah, with Kelly, he's coming along with some side sessions. I think the thing they want to be careful with is he's had a hamstring issue before when he was with St. Louis. It happened as he was running the bases, as pitchers sometimes have to do in the National League, and he ended up missing about 2 months because of that. So, as you guys know, with any muscle pull, whether it's a lat or a hamstring or a calf muscle or groin or whatever, these things can get aggravated pretty quickly, and instead of missing 2 or 2.5 weeks, you end up missing 2 months the way Kelly did a few years ago with the Cardinals before coming over here in the trade. So I think he's making progress on the side, but it's probably going to be a little bit before he's back because they want to be careful. Trying to remember, who's the other reliever you asked about?
Carson Smith.
Yeah, Carson Smith, sorry. He's with the team. He threw a side session Friday in Anaheim, the first day of the trip, and I think he's scheduled to throw again here in Seattle either today or tomorrow. There'll probably be one more side after that before they probably have him face some live hitters or sort of live batting practice or simulated game up here. And then after that, it's time to go on a rehab at Pawtucket. I think that when you look at, even though he's kind of a one-inning guy and it's not, you're not building up the arm strength that you would need for a starter, I think the unofficial target date for Carson Smith being able to help at the big league level is probably around September 1st. So we're probably a month or so away from him. And that's assuming no setbacks, but he could be back by the start of September.
So over the weekend, some more details coming out with that David Price, Tanner Secretly confrontation. And obviously, David Price hasn't apologized to Eck. Neither has John Farrell. I want to ask you, what do you make of John Farrell's handling of this whole ordeal?
I think it leaves something to be desired, frankly. I think that, you know, this is an example of a team perhaps mollifying or coddling a star player and not holding him accountable as they should. I think Price's behavior was immature and over the top and not acceptable for a professional and a major leaguer. And I think that Farrell has made a mistake by not holding Price more accountable and not having him apologize to Eckersley. The organization does not look good here, and that's an understatement.
We're talking to Sean McAdam of Boston Sports Journal. And for those of you wondering, we keep mentioning this, Boston Sports Journal, they're launching today, Monday the 24th, if you're listening to this show. A little later on, some real Boston Blue Bloods, the brainchild of Greg Bedard, formerly of SI. You got Christopher Price, of course, Sean covering the Red Sox. Sean, for those who are wondering why they should subscribe to Boston Sports Journal, what sets you guys apart from, you know, ESPN Boston or the Globe or whatever?
Well, I mean, we don't want to put down any other site. You know, there's a lot of good material out there, and we're not about, you know, saying that you know, these other guys aren't doing it right. We are. We're trying to provide our vision of what a, you know, the kind of sports site we would like to read. And that means, you know, no clickbait, no contrarian takes that are supposed to stir up artificial debate, and no contrived looks or getting into any of that stuff. This is sort of, I hesitate to use the word old-fashioned because that doesn't play well you know, in 2017, but it is kind of a back-to-basics approach of covering Boston sports with a bunch of experienced guys who have done this with some success for a while, and all of whom have been victims of some of the evolution that's taken place. I say victims, you know, in terms of losing our job. We're not dying here, but we all experienced the downturn, and we've all lost jobs, and we are eager to, you know, get back and provide the kind of coverage that we think people appreciate, which is a reasoned, informed, experienced look at what's going on. We want to react to breaking news. We want to break news on our own, and we want to provide some context. There's a lot out there, obviously. Some of it's free. Some of it you have to pay a little money for, but it's a crowded marketplace, and we're trying to separate ourselves and stand out in bringing good writing, good reporting, good analysis, and good journalism, because we think people maybe don't find that as much as they used to, and frankly, we think it's worth paying a little bit of money for, and if I may, I would urge people to go check out the site at bostonsportsjournal.com. It's pretty affordable, if I do say so myself. It's $4.99 a month. It's $35 for the year. And there are some discounts for both those at the student level and those serving in the military, active and retired. So we've tried to make it as inviting as possible. It is going to be free, as this is taped today on the 24th. It's free for the first week, and a paywall goes up next Monday, the 31st. But we're thrilled at the response that we've gotten in the first few hours. Last I checked, we are up to over 500 subscriptions in the first 3 hours. You know, we'd urge people to check it out and hope they like it.
How did this opportunity come about for you? When did Greg tell you about him potentially making this site, and when did you know that this was gonna, you know, come to fruition?
Yeah, I was first approached by Greg a couple of months ago. He had taken note of a site in Pittsburgh, DK Sports, which is the model upon which we are based. Same sort of model where there is a paywall, there is a monthly and annual subscription fee, but Greg saw how well this was being done in Pittsburgh. They travel with the Pittsburgh teams. They have amassed about 40,000 subscribers in 3 years and a staff of 11 full-time reporters and editors. And he thought that if it could work in Pittsburgh, which is a good sports city and a good sports market, then surely it could also work here in Boston. And so he started, you know, from a business standpoint, getting the template and the business model from DK Sports, and then started to look around and put a staff together and approached me. I was thrilled that he did. We talked several times about his idea and plan. He told me about how he saw this working, how he was going to finance it, how it was going to be successful, and you know, I was in with both feet right from the beginning, and was excited to be part of it. And it feels good to be on the ground floor of something that you really believe in.
I can't wait to start reading, Sean. You already got my money for sure. You can find Sean McAdam again on bostonsportsjournal.com, free for the first week. Highly recommend everybody checks that. I've already read, I think, if not all, most of the articles that are up there, some real good, insightful, you know, X's and O's kind of stuff. Looking forward to what's ahead. Sean, thanks for coming on.
My pleasure, guys, and thanks for letting me talk about it and helping to steer some people toward it. We're excited about it. Thanks
again.
Oh,
of course. Us too. Thank you.
Colin, it is a Snap Call Sports production. Snap Call Sports is available for iPhone or Android download. Snap Call, the game within the game.
The price is wrong, bitch.
Welcome back into Call It. Thanks, Sean McAdam, for talking Red Sox with us. And we got into it at the end there, Alex. David Price. We know the details. Him and Eckersley, it's not good.
Not good at all. David Price looks pretty bad. He looks as bad as you can look in one of these
Pablo
situations.
Pablo Sandoval looked bad. Price looks like he's in some trouble.
Yeah, he like straight up a bully. Not to like a random, like, it's not like he's bullying Tom Caron, which would be bad as well. He's bullying a Hall of Fame pitcher, someone who had a career that was so much better than what David Price has and what he will ever have. He bullied him.
And not just better. Price talks about, oh, the game's so easy for Dennis Eckersley. He doesn't know how hard this game is. He gave up the Kirk Gibson home run.
Yeah.
He got shuttled back and forth in rotation of the bullpen.
All while battling a drug problem.
Baseball was not, I don't want to say baseball was not kind to Dennis Eckersley, because it was. He had a very good career. Yeah. But he didn't waltz into that career. He didn't waltz into the Hall of Fame. No, he is one of... Like, you talk about people who earned their spot in Cooperstown, he's up there.
Absolutely. And the reality is, if a guy like that is criticizing you, it probably means something. He's not just throwing it around there. I know he's a very critical guy on air. He has his persona.
But it's not even that he criticized Price. It's that he criticized Eduardo Rodriguez, which, I mean, and if you, I don't know if you read the Karabas piece, Jared Karabas of Barstool Sports.
I haven't
yet.
I will though.
And he points out very, and other people have said this too. I just saw it first from Karabas, and we all know Karabas has so much credibility.
Yes.
So of course you got to give Karabas credit for his credibility. He said Price just used the Eduardo Rodriguez thing as a chance to go after Eckersley for himself, which I 100% believe.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's trying so hard to be that good teammate, even though he is so mentally weak, that he's not going to make up for his mental weakness. Like, it seems like, I don't know. He's trying to restore his image with his team, I feel like.
Well, no, this is what scares me, is that he got a standing ovation for this outburst. It sounds like the team likes him. He is seen as a good teammate. And what does that say about this Red Sox team? Are they mentally strong enough to handle a playoff run?
Absolutely.
Are they even likable?
Yeah. And those are valid questions. And that's why the question I posed to Sean was, you know, what do you think of John Farrell's handling of this? And another one I was going to ask is, do you think if David Ortiz was on this team, and I know we overuse going back to, like, if Ortiz was on this team. But
no, but the point needs to be made.
Would this fly? Dan Shaughnessy, in his article on the Boston Globe, said that, you know, this same thing happened to him and Brooks Robinson, obviously one of the best third basemen of all time, told the team, I forget the guy's name who had the outburst, but pretty much forced him to apologize to Dan Shaughnessy, of all people. Dan Shaughnessy was 24 years old. He's probably kind of, you know, played that trollish figure, and I mean that with all due respect.
Oh, no, he takes it as a compliment.
Yeah, so and they don't have that guy on this team. I don't understand. Why doesn't Pedroia go to David Price and be like, listen, you can't do that? Like, that's just like, it, for one, it's going to be a distraction. The media will catch wind of this. And two, you should respect that guy. If you may not you may not agree with him, but you should respect that guy.
So here's the story. I just pulled it up from Karabas via Shaughnessy. So we get both our sources.
Yes.
Here. This is on this is Barstool Sports quoting the Boston Globe. So a little bit of Shaughnessy, a little bit of Karabas. Let me see if I can get to the point here where I was looking at. So on the day of the episode, Price was standing near the middle of the team aircraft surrounded by fellow players waiting for Eckersley. When Eckersley approached on his way to the back of the plane, Red Sox broadcasters traditionally sit near the rear of the aircraft, a grandstanding Price stood in front of Eckersley and shouted, "Here he is, the greatest pitcher who ever lived. The game is easy for him." When a stunned Eckersley tried to speak, Price shot back, "Get the F out of here." Many players applauded.
And that's unacceptable.
Why are players applauding this?
Because
why are players applauding this mental softness? The dude's got a soft serve machine in his head.
And this all stems from John Farrell. That's he accepts,
you think so?
Absolutely. He accepts this kind of behavior to fly, and he accepts that mentality. It's not you versus the media. It's you versus the AL East. It's you versus the AL and the MLB. Instead, their frustration's going towards the media. Well, guess what? The outing that Eduardo Rodriguez had in Pawtucket was not good.
No, it wasn't.
So,
it was yikes or yuck or whatever he said.
Is he
was.
Supposed to ignore that? Be like, you know what? He's trying his best. That's not his job.
And it's Nesson. I mean, obviously they're going to clean it up because and there's nothing wrong with that. The team owns Nesson. It's a team-owned broadcast.
Yeah.
But you can only clean it up so much. And now I'm worried with Devers getting called up, and you have young players like Betts and Bogarts. If Price is a leader in this clubhouse, is this what the Red Sox are going to be for the next 10 or 15 years? Is this the lesson those guys are learning? And that shouldn't... The Red Sox have always been a very mentally tough team. You go back to Kevin Millar and the Idiots.
Yeah.
Right? Don't count us out.
2013.
You know, call us a pack of frauds. We'll prove you wrong. Imagine if this Red Sox team, if Shaughnessy wrote an article calling this Red Sox team a pack of frauds, they lose 5 straight.
They'd probably jump them. In the alleys of Yaki Way.
I'm not a fraud. I'm not as good as Jim Irvin.
I'm not a fraud. You're a fraud. You're such a fraud.
I sound like a frog.
I sound like Kermit the Frog. Get the F out of here. Go to the back of the plane. Mr. Baseball's so easy for you.
But like...
Shout out Jim Irvin.
Right. I don't want... Okay, we were just talking about soft PR. 13-year anniversary. I can't believe it's been 13 years.
Crazy.
13-year anniversary of Jason Varitek getting up in the face of Alex Rodriguez for really no reason.
Yeah.
Like, let's be honest. Yeah, A-Rod was chirping at the pitcher. I'm not saying Veritek wasn't justified, but that happens. He was just looking for any excuse he could to pop A-Rod in the mouth.
It's like when Dempster threw at A-Rod four straight times. It's the same thing.
There's nobody on this team that's going to do that. They stick up for each other against the media because they won't against other players. The whole thing with Manny Machado I forgot about back in
Dustin
May.
Dustin Pedroian, he was a part of the problem then. And this goes, and this is something I've been saying since before the season. Dustin Pedroian is not a very good leader.
You're right. You know what Ortiz would have done? You know what Pedroia needs to do when David Price tells Eck to get the F out of here? Pedroia needs to stand up and say, no, you get the F out of here. That's a Hall of Famer.
It's unacceptable. And again, we already cast blame on John Farrell, but I don't think it can be overstated. This guy is accepting this to happen. There's no mediation between him and Eckersley. There's no you got to tone it down between him and Price. At least there hasn't been anything reported. He completely dismisses it when he's asked about it. We've moved on as a team. You know what? You should condemn what David Price did because
Absolutely. It
was wrong. It was wrong, and you've been in the MLB long enough to know that that's wrong.
Now, let me ask you this. Since the All-Star break, the Red Sox split 2-4 against the Yankees, one of those games they really should have won. They split 2-4 against, I think it was Toronto, one of the games they really should have won. And then they were 1-2 against Los Angeles, which was fair. If they're winning, is this as big of an issue right now? If they come out of the All-Star break and win like 7-10, like they should have.
I think so, because didn't the Eckersley thing happen during a winning streak?
You know, it's just piling on. And now that they're not playing well, and look, Seattle's, I know the West is kind of a mess. Seattle's a decent team.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to have to face Felix Hernandez, who is still, I think, a top 10 pitcher in the league, even though he's not what he once was. At what point does it become in that Red Sox clubhouse, they're just piling on to us? First, they're criticizing us for cheering David Price, and now they're saying we're not playing well. They're not going to play well. It's a West Coast road trip. You don't. That's just how the best teams struggle going coast to coast.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I think that this inconsistency problem with the Red Sox isn't new. I think that's something that's been going on all of John Farrell's Red Sox career, with the exception of 2013. And I think they're used to this. There's going to be media criticism because for every, you know, every time they win 8 out of 10, they're losing, you know, 6 out of 10.
They're, I think, 3-7 in their last 10 right now.
Exactly. And it's always these spurts of playing well and then playing like crap, playing well and then playing like crap. And again, it's John Farrell. He's the one common factor, and he's the one guy, unless he has a clubhouse with proven veterans, with proven clubhouse leaders like that 2013 season, he cannot lead a team. He just can't. He's not a guy who can come out there and really command a clubhouse. He lets his players run wild, and he tries to be a player coach type of guy. It doesn't work with him because look what's happening here.
I have chills going down my spine just bringing this up, but we have an inconsistent team, a manager who seems to let things fly, a concerning leader in the clubhouse. I mean, is it 2011? Are we talking chicken and beer? Okay, let me say this. We're not, because this team's in first place, and they are playing well. Mm-hmm. I think that the talent isn't living up to what we expected, but they are playing well. So this is more for conversation's sake. Is Farrell starting to enter Bobby? I think after he won the World Series, everybody anointed him Terry Francona's
successor
and, yeah. It's Francona 2.0.
Yeah.
But is he starting on a scale of Francona to Valentine?
He's closer
to starting
Valentine.
To head a little more towards Valentine.
He's closer to Valentine.
That's scary.
Absolutely, he is. You know, and I think it goes back to respect. I don't know if players really respect him as the authority figure.
And
that
was the problem with Valentine.
And it was the problem with Francona a little bit. You know, obviously,
players love Francona.
They loved him, but
do you know the stories about him taking dumps during meetings, right?
He used to call
players into his office to talk, and he just had the door open, taking a dump. It was like his favorite thing to do.
Yeah, he's
like that. That you have to respect that.
Yeah, and he almost died when he was without baseball. I don't know if you saw that, but
I did.
Yeah, he's definitely closer to Valentine. It's definitely becoming a problem. The leadership with this clubhouse.
All right, we'll see what Price can do this week. Obviously, a lot to make up for. On the other side, European Open. Keep it here. You're listening to CallNet, brought to you by Snap Call Sports.
Colin, it is a Snap Call Sports production. Snap Call Sports is available for iPhone or Android download. Snap Call, the game within the game.
Welcome back to Calling It. Alex Barth, Alex Lebowitz, Mike Zago, Snap Call Sports, joins us on the phone. Mike, how you doing?
Good. Happy to be here.
Well, we are, what, 3 out of 4 majors through the summer as it winds down? The British Open was this past weekend. It might have been the best major of the year, maybe just because I wasn't a huge fan of who won the Masters. But I don't know, Mike, that might have been the most entertaining golf we've seen in 2017.
It was good. I mean, it seemed like it was going to be a runaway. And then, you know, Jordan found a way to make it interesting for us on Sunday. He could have ran away and hid, and the whole back nine would have been kind of pointless for anyone to watch. But he really didn't, and he made it interesting and made us wonder whether he was going to be Captain Meltdown for the rest of his life.
He really did try to hide behind the sponsor trucks at one point on 13. In a hole. I mean, that hole is going to be tied to his legacy, I think. And that's kind of where I want to start this conversation. I'm a big Spieth guy. I love rooting for the favorite. I'm not a big underdog person. That whole ordeal kind of made me start to not like him. And then the comeback was awesome. So, Jordan, we're good now. But do you guys think that helped or hurt Spieth's image, the way he handled the 13th hole?
I think it's crazy that he knew so many fans didn't know the rules in the time. And it was confusing, right? You were waiting 20 minutes to take a shot, and he's a notoriously slow player to begin with, so that was frustrating a lot of people.
Baseball thought that pace of play was bad.
Yeah, it was bad. It wasn't a great look, especially since there weren't that many other people playing already. They were already on the back nine. A lot of people finished. So it was a little weird, and credit to his caddy for knowing exactly what was going on and giving him the options. And, you know, once the ball was deemed unplayable, more than 9 out of 10, I mean, 99 out of 100 people are just going to go back to the tee box, take their next shot, hit a 3-wood, make sure you're on the fairway, and just, you know, pray to make double bogey at that point. But he knew that he had an option there. The line of sight was right. If you went a little bit backwards behind that hill, the practice ground was there. The driving range was over there. They ruled that was in play coming into the week, and he must have known that. I don't know who thought to ask that before the round started, but they did, and it was in play. And so he knew that if he could just lift the ball over that hill, he had a pretty good look. And the funny thing was, he wasn't even happy with the shot when he took it. It looked like he was frustrated, like he shot it off to the right. It didn't even hit the fairway. And then, you know, the shot after that, the chip up onto the green, he was able to one putt and get up and down, and that just really turned everything. You just saw it in his eyes. It was just it was pretty much over from there. He knew that he was going to nail everything after that.
For me, it's not like he's always had this image of being a choker. There's been so many points where he's been up and then he's just fallen off in the back nine and the final round of a lot of different tournaments. It kind of dispelled that for me yesterday, though. What is he? He's 24 years old. He's at the, you know, start of his career relatively, and he closed it out. He got that eagle and he kept the lead and he won by 2 strokes. Probably should have been more given how he crumbled there earlier in the back nine. But still, for me, this dispels the notion that Jordan Spieth is a choker. He's someone who kind of has the attitude you need to be a superstar in golf. I know a lot of people might disagree with me, but the way he finished it out there, I think that's, you know, even though, again, he did choke a little bit in the beginning, I think that's more notable than anything else from this tournament.
I actually think it's super important that he did it this way. And if he ran away and hid, he still might have had that choker mentality in him, even though it was another major win, because this way you saw that he was on the cusp of doing it again. It had to be going through his mind. He's a young kid. He's had success, but he's also had epic meltdowns. And once he hits the ball a mile right, it's unplayable, and it's got to be going through his head. He's like, Kuchar's right on my butt. Is this happening again? This can't happen again to me. And so the fact that he was able to overcome the bad start rather than just run away and hide, either way he would have won. But I think this is almost, you know, it could change his legacy even more moving forward, because the next time that he struggles on a back nine for a couple holes, he's going to say to himself, you know what? I did this already. I came back and I shot, 5 under on the last 5 holes or something like that, and maybe 6 under. So you know, he's ready for this. And now I think that could put it in the rearview mirror.
I'll tell you this, though, and Mike, we talked about this a little bit before. Being on a Lynx course really helped him. His driver was awful. His driver was awful. Yeah. And not, sure, you know, PGA awful. It was me going out and playing on a Saturday awful.
Yeah, that familiar slice was there for sure.
And like, on, I've played a Lynx course, and I've landed in similar places that he landed. I'm not hitting the ball as far, but on a regular course, sure, where you have a more wooded surrounding, he's not going to be able to play a lot of those balls. He's going to lose strokes. I think he got very lucky given the circumstances. If he hits the ball like that at, say, Augusta, he's nowhere near the top.
Yeah. I mean, even think about the 13th. If the
right, that's not in play anywhere else.
No. Well, even if he's able to pull the ball backwards on the same line, he would have had to hop a forest to get over that instead of just a hill with no trees around. So, yeah, I mean, credit for knowing what he needed to do. He won on this course. It's all you can do.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, you're probably right. If this is any other major, he doesn't get away with that kind of stuff. And he probably has to pull some crazy scrambling. And who knows if he can do it. But, you know, you could play the what if game all day long. He did get it done. And so it's hard to knock him for that. But yeah, the driver, he'll need to fix it by the time the PGA Championship rolls around.
I will say this. My favorite part of the weekend, as cool as the Spieth comeback was actually Brandon Grace, the South African, shot a 62. Yeah. I wake up, I was doing the tournament for Snap Call and try Snap Call Golf. It's great. I highly recommend it. I think our next tournament is next week.
It is, yep.
If I'm correct, yep. So, you know, we're not going to start at 4 a.m., which Mike makes a schedule. Mike, thank you so much for that. And I go down, I turn on the TV at like 9:30. I'm starting at 10 o'clock, and all of a sudden they're talking about, we have a historical round going. I'm like, nobody at the top is even on there. Brandon Grace comes out, shoots the first 62 in major men's history. And it was awesome because this guy, he came out of nowhere. And that, as much as I love the front runner, it was really cool to watch because he was genuinely enjoying every minute of it.
And the coolest part about it to me was on Thursday when Spieth shot the 65, I said to myself, he didn't even do anything crazy out there. He just played mistake-free golf on a wide-open course and hit a lot of putts. And so I was thinking, no, some other guys can really make runs and do this same kind of thing if you just don't make epic mistakes. And then Grace comes up, and he just did it even better. It's like when you're out there playing and you say to yourself, man, if I just didn't miss that short putt and didn't flub this chip and top out on the tee that one time, I would have shot a pretty good score. And Brandon Grace was probably looking around saying, he probably didn't even realize at some point.
Yeah, he said he didn't know until after.
It looked like in his eyes he was just like, oh, man, I haven't really screwed up yet. And the putt was going down, and just like everything came together, and all of a sudden he finishes on the card, and you're like, that guy must have had a really good round. You go back, you see a lot of circled numbers and zero bogeys, and that's how you do it. You don't have to be it's more important to not make mistakes than it is to make hero shots. And that's exactly what he did. It was unbelievable to watch.
And then you have, I'm blanking on his first name, the Chinese golfer, Li. He then comes out the next day and shoots a 63.
Unbelievable. Yeah. Where did he come from? And, you know, good for him, because if not for him and not for Rory's really good run also, he was quiet in all this but had another top five finish, it really would have been a little less exciting, because at least you had Li there at -6, I believe he was. And you thought to yourself, well, if these guys bogey down the stretch and really do fall apart, they're at least going to have to stay above that mark, you know? And so if we didn't have that and people were at, what, -4, it would have been really less exciting. So, yeah, for him having big runs, that course is made for low scores in single rounds. It was just really hard, it seemed, to put together four good rounds, and credit to Spieth for being able to do it.
Yeah, it's funny. I think golf's the only sport where you root for the no-name who's setting a course record, but you also root for the face of the game and Jordan Spieth. For me, at least, I was rooting for Jordan Spieth the entire time, and I'm kind of just rooting for a close back nine down the stretch. Is that something that's completely unique to golf, and is that a problem in golf? Because I've been trying to think about that.
I can't think of many other sports where you root for the front runner like you do it, because I think it's more of it's an individual sport thing versus a team sport thing. It's harder to see that overwhelming accomplishment in a team sport, whereas when it's an individual, especially I think too with golf, because I mean, a lot of people, you know, you play football, you throw the ball around the backyard. A lot of people go out and they play golf, and you know the feeling when you're 4 or 5 holes. Well, some of us know the feeling. I haven't in a while. When you've played 4 or 5 holes, you're like, you know what? I'm playing well. I haven't made too many mistakes. Like, that's a great feeling. And to see it done on that stage is kind of cool.
It's incredible. And the reason it's not relatable, but it is at the same time, because you see these guys put up birdies and you say to yourself, man, I have like one birdie all year.
Right.
And so it really is exciting. It becomes a little easier, I think, to root for the favorite. One, because the field is so big, and it's a game that's just so difficult to win consistently. Look what Dustin Johnson's doing right now. He's having his struggles, but it doesn't mean he can't come out there in the PGA Championship and win. He's still going to be a favorite. So I think it's difficult to win week to week, and that's why you can still get behind a favorite. Whereas, you know, when you're watching the Patriots, they're just going to win. Like, there's no, it's easier for them to become a villain.
Mike, and we
to become a villain.
We talked about this earlier in the show, but did you see the USA Today preview?
I did.
Okay.
I did.
I just wanted to ask if you saw that. Mike's a Jets fan.
I'm just salty about it.
But back to the Jordan Spieth, like, everyone loves him. Yeah. Like, again, is that good for golf? Like, what sells more, hatred or love? Like, if he was a controversial figure and still was the same caliber of golfer, would that be better for golf? Because would people just love to see him choke and lose?
Well, talking about controversial figure, we didn't even talk about this. How about yesterday when he hits the birdie to take the lead back, just walks off the green, tells his caddy, go get the ball. That was awesome. I loved that. Some people hated that. I loved that.
I love that too, but it kind of seems hard to create a villain in golf. I mean, think back, like, how many can you really think of? They just don't really exist very much. Like, take Dustin Johnson, for example. Yeah. This guy's been suspended for some stuff that he's done off the course. He doesn't have a great track record in the past. But when he's killing the ball 400 yards off the tee and dominating the field with pure athleticism, everyone's rooting for him. And so what do you have to do to be a villain in golf? There just really aren't that many of them. It's not that kind of sport, it seems, which is kind of refreshing, right? I mean, it's nice to be able to root for anybody that's doing well, and that's kind of how I feel about it. And it seems as though that's kind of how the league kind of runs itself. The PGA in general just doesn't create a lot of animosity. And, you know, you even see it when two guys are battling down the stretch. You don't see them trash-talking very much. It's mostly just like handshakes and, you know, tip of the cap. And it's just refreshing. It's just different than every other sport. I don't know if it's better or worse, but it's something. There's just so much respect there for such a difficult game that you have to tip your cap to these guys who are having ridiculous rounds, and it's just hard to hate on them.
Well, I think instead of villains in golf, you have, and I mean, I use this word too much, but you have clowns. You have guys that are, you don't necessarily hate them, but in a way, Sergio's a clown.
Bubba Watson,
Beef, right, who is like one of my favorite golfers.
John Daly,
made the
of course.
Cut. John Daly is the ultimate. Like, you just have these guys that they're not necessarily villains, but given that golf has such a history of being an uptight, rigid, by-the-books game, you have these guys that come out and they have a little fun with it, and they're villains to the traditionalists, but to us, I'm trying to figure out how to work. They're not villains, but they are different. They set themselves apart from the game.
And you got to give the PGA some credit for letting these guys have a little bit
absolutely.
Of leeway there. I mean, what about John Daly could easily be portrayed as a villain of some kind. Like, come on, look at the guy. But everyone loves watching him play because he's so relatable for the everyday fan.
John Daly wouldn't exist in the NFL. And that's what's great about the PGA is they almost encourage – well, I don't want to say that kind of behavior with John Daly because he goes a little over the top, but you know what I mean.
But they let him be himself.
Right.
Which is important. And a lot of leagues aren't willing to do that because they're worried about their image. And, you know, like you said, for a sport that's pretty uptight, they don't really get in the way of the golfers' personalities, which is kind of cool. And maybe so that could be part of the reason why you don't see as much hatred for the players against each other, because they don't have to pretend to be something they're not. They just get out there, they hit the ball. Whoever has the best score, everyone's like, wow, that was a really good round. And you get out there the next week and do the same thing. And so they all just genuinely seem like they're having fun with each other. And I'm sure there are people on the tour that don't like each other, but you really don't see it, and they don't put it in the forefront. And so it's kind of just a happy game. It just seems that way, at least on TV. And they do a really good job with that.
Okay, real quick here before we wrap it up. Again, we're talking with Mike Zago, Snap Call Sports. Real quick answer. Jordan Spieth at the PGA Championship in a couple weeks. He's going to be going for the career Grand Slam. I think there's going to be some big-time ratings on this one. Not in general. This year, 2017 PGA Championship. Alex, we'll start with you. Does Jordan Spieth pick up the career Grand Slam?
No.
No? Mike?
For him, I mean, it's hard to call anyone that's going to win. I think you'll see him settle down with the driver, maybe take some more three woods and irons off the tee, but I can't count out a guy that putts like that. It's ridiculous. I assume everything's going to go down. So I fully expect him to be in contention on the final day.
I think if he can win it this year, and I think he'll pick up the career Grand Slam eventually. If he can win it this year, given how he played at the Travelers, and I know it's the Travelers, but given how he played at the Travelers and the comeback at the British Open, I mean, you're starting to look at Tiger territory. That's a Tiger kind of thing to get this absurdly hot.
When Tiger was this good, the putter was red hot. When everyone's, you have to putt really well
right.
to win these tournaments. And Jordan putts better than, I don't want to say anyone I've ever seen, but
he's up.
I mean, those are the words coming out of my mouth. So, I can't count him out on any given day because you saw it yesterday. He didn't shoot well. The ball wasn't coming off the club well, and he still ran away. So I can't count that guy out. He might win.
All right, that'll do it for this segment. I'd like to thank Mike Zago for coming on, talking some golf with us. And again, SnapCall golf coverage. I can't remember the name of the tournament, honestly, off the top of my head. I know it's next Sunday.
We're going to be doing every tournament every Sunday from here in through 2 weeks in the PGA, and we'll do both days on the PGA.
There you go. So check that all out. Download SnapCall Sports for iPhone or Android. You can follow him on Twitter at Zago. Mike Zago, thanks so much.
Thanks.
Do it for us, not for this week, actually, just for Monday. We will be back on Friday. Alex and I are going to training camp down at Gillette. We will have a training camp recap for you of Thursday and Friday, Friday afternoon, so keep posted for that. Anything else you want to plug this week?
John Lebo Show back this week. We didn't have an episode last week due to technical difficulties, but we'll be back Thursday. We send
hopefully.
It out there. Hopefully. It'll be there.
You can catch me Tuesday on CLNS Media pre-post for the Red Sox 10 o'clock game. Hope you'll stay up with me. So we'll be back on Friday, and then on Monday, it's the trading deadline. Might as well tease that too. We will be live on Periscope and who knows what else Monday, hour and a half prior to the deadline. We'll then record the show after the deadline and post that. For updates on that, you can follow us on Twitter at Calling It Podcast. Also follow us on SoundCloud as well. So until Friday, he's Alex Lebowitz. I'm Alex Barth. I'd like to thank Mike Zago of SnapCall Sports, Sean McAdam of BostonSportsJournal.com for coming on. For all of us, we will. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you soon. Bye.
You've been listening to Callin' It. This episode has been brought to you by SnapCall Sports. SnapCall, the game within the game. Available for iPhone or Android.